There haven't been too many things to celebrate in 2020, but it's nice to see the year out with one joyous occasion, which is the 40th birthday of the debut album from Young Marble Giants. And joining us on the phone on 2SER is one of those giants, Stuart Moxham. How are you?
I'm very well, Chris. How are you?
I'm good, and I should say happy birthday to your record. It must be like an occasional birthday, celebrating the birthday of an album. It sort of rolls around every so often.
I guess it does. It completely caught me by surprise. A bit like my own 40th.
Stuart, is it confronting to think about something you made 40 years ago, or are you still as proud of it and happy to acknowledge it as ever?
It's both those things, Chris, really. Of course, I'm profoundly grateful to it, you know, because it's sort of brought me to where I am, really, and still does, you know. I mean, it's an absolute phenomenon, you know. We might have overachieved a little bit there, you know.
Well, we'll talk about that in a bit, because it was the only album that the band made, but is it almost post-subjective by now anyway, Stuart, this album? I mean, it's been poured over so much in those 40 years. It's even had one of those 33 and a third books written about it.
Indeed. To be honest, it was made kind of from intuition. I wasn't a great musician or anything. I'm still not. And I was having to sort of find a way to achieve something that seemed impossible, you know. And it involved a lot of mental tricks, really, where I sort of distanced myself from the reality of it, you know, in my mind. So consequently, reading and doing interviews and reading about it and all the rest of it and reading what critics say and things has kind of unraveled it for me over the 40 years, you know.
That's almost like the beauty of this album in a nutshell, Stuart. It feels like it's such a moment in time, and I guess its strongest points feel like the naivety and unfussy simplicity of this record, which would almost be like trying to put lightning in a bottle. It feels like it might be something you were only able to do once.
Yeah, I think it probably is. I mean, I often wonder to myself why I haven't done anything like it since, you know, because it was a very strong idea, and that gave us tremendous confidence as a little gang, a little musical gang. And even though what we were doing was challenging for the audience as well as for us, we knew that it worked. We knew that we had something good. Even though we're all, I think it's fair to say, pretty much introverts. And certainly Phil and Alison are not the sort of people who, you know, not chest beaters exactly, you know. So in a way, we're kind of going against what the music business, the conventional music business, is all about, which is chest beaters. It's people who are full of self-confidence saying, you know, I'm better than you and I've got more gold discs on the wall and all that kind of stuff, you know.
It's still amazing how out of step the album sounds with so much of what else was going on musically in 1980 as well. And I guess that might be one of the reasons it hasn't carbon dated itself, even when you look at the kind of cooler records that were coming out at the time, things like Sandinista or Closer or 17 Seconds. It was sort of this boys' club, and they were these big albums designed to make an impression, weren't they?
I guess so. I mean, we felt out of step when we arrived at Rough Trade. I found the whole punk thing quite disappointing. I thought there's this huge buzz about it, but it's really just rock and roll a bit faster. And we got to Rough Trade and everyone wanted to be Keith Richards still, and they're all wearing black leather and stuff. You know, I turned up in an orange Harris Tweed three-piece suit. Absolutely boiling hot. I thought, what am I doing?
You were the most punk person there, Stuart.
There you are. Says a lot.
Were you also trying to create music that you weren't hearing anywhere else as well? Was Young Marble Giants the sound you trying to react against what else was going on?
Absolutely, yeah, totally. I mean, what I did, my little mental trick was, okay, I've got this opportunity to sort of start a musical career as a songwriter with Phil and Alison in this new band we've agreed to do. And sort of it's quite terrifying when actually a huge ambition, you actually get an opportunity, even if you have to create it yourself. So it was quite terrifying. And I thought, right, I'll imagine a group, not this one, but an actually imaginary group, and I'll write for that group. What would I like that group to sound like? What would I like their songs to be like? So that's what I did.
So it was almost like an out-of-body experience.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly that. And of course, because I wasn't singing the words, And because a woman was singing the words, it was much easier for me. I could suddenly dig out my own personal, emotional life because I didn't have to stand in front of an audience and do it as a bloke.
So it was almost one step removed. You were able to put a lot of thoughts into songs that you wouldn't have had the courage to sing directly yourself.
Absolutely. And I was very lucky that in Alison, there was somebody I could sing her the song, you know, once, and she'd get it straight away, absolutely perfectly. I mean, this is all happenstances. I didn't know anything about these things at the time, you know.
And Stuart, I know that your own favourite song is NITA, Nature Intended the Abstract. Is that because you can hear the hurt of young love in a song like that? It's got that great line, "No rain outside but tears in my eyes," which is a very young love kind of line to have in a song.
Yeah, I think it's the most resonant of my childhood. You know, our mum's in there, a 1950s mum, and the fact that we played in the street, you know, and she would call us in. Some of that stuff, you know, was written about life at the time it was written, you know, out on the rooftop for a surprise. We lived in this bizarre house when we were writing, Phil and I were writing that music, and you could see right out across the southern part of Cardiff, right down to the steelworks and out to the Bristol Channel. So that's where that line came from, up on the rooftop for a surprise. So it was a mixture of things.
And Stuart, going back to the album itself, usually the sound of Revolution and Reaction is loud. So how did the three of you decide to make it so quiet? I mean, I guess you didn't have the luxury of money and time in creating it. And was there no room to second guess a lot of what you were doing when you were making the Young Marble Giants album?
It was all incredibly pragmatic. You know, Phil and I discussed the sound we were going to have and what our band was going to be like, you know, and it was easy, really. I mean, you just look at all the conventions and don't do any of them. You know, everything's loud, so we'll be quiet. Everything's distorted, so we won't be distorted, you know. Everyone's got a drummer. We don't want a drummer. Everyone uses an introduction. Bollocks to that, you know, we're not going to have that. So in a way, it was very easy. And you end up with minimalism. And minimalism, for me, is a sexy thing, you know. It's sort of so anti this world of what you said at the beginning, you know, overstimulation, this world of everything's overrated.
Minimalism also leaves room for the listener to then project some things of their own in there. There's room in a song.
Yes. Yeah, I didn't think that at the time. I didn't know that at the time. But yeah. And somehow or other, people have said over and over again, there's a lot of mystery and darkness in that record. And, you know, I was totally unaware of those things. I didn't really put all the lyrics together in one place until Domino took the record on. I'd never really looked at all the lyrics in one go. And they're immensely sad, actually, which was quite shocking, you know. But I think a lot of people in this lark of songwriting are really trying to discover themselves, you know. They're trying to discover who they are by doing this. It's a process of externalization. And what we've discovered, and I know Alison feels the same way about this, is that we've drawn birds of a feather. You know, we've drawn people towards us. Our music has done that. And that's the best thing about it, really.
And Stuart, the Young Marble Giants' legacy has been immense. You've been covered by everyone from Hole to Galaxy 500 to Bell and Sebastian. There was even a band from Australia called Toys Went Berserk who did one. And it's an influence, an aesthetic that's continued on through younger bands like the XX. I mean, is that all very flattering to still see the relevance and the reach that this band has had, even though you only made one album?
Totally. Yeah, of course. I mean, I think, as you said, it's sort of an aesthetic. You sort of outlined an aesthetic that hadn't really been done before, I think. You've opened a key for me there, opened the lock. I think in terms of rock pools, you know, we built a rock pool for people to put their heads into, you know, and see stuff they hadn't seen before. And it's happened in literature and in poetry and stuff and in film. And I guess we did it in music, you know. I mean, other people have done it as well in music. So only doing one album didn't really matter that we only did one if it got the job done, you know.
Well, I am thankful that we got that one rock pool and that one album from Young Marble Giants, Stuart.
Thank you.
We might have a listen to Brand New Life off the album now. This was the one covered by Australian band Toys Went Berserk. It was great to talk to you
right
on 2SER. Who knows, maybe in another 40 years, if they invent Eternal Life, we can talk about this record again.
Yeah, maybe 50 years, maybe, you know, 10 years from now.
We'll book it in.
Okay, thanks, Chris.
Thanks, Stuart. This is Young Marble Giants now on 2SER.